I want to invite your attention this evening to the book of 1 Kings in chapter number 8. 1 Kings chapter 8. But before I read the text, I do want to take just a few minutes to bring your minds back. It has been some 6 weeks or so since we have left off our series, Sunday night series through 1 Kings. And I just want to sort of bring your mind back there to what has been going on. You will remember King Solomon has undertaken this massive building project, the temple complex, which included Solomon's own palace, the palace of his Egyptian bride, the house of the forest of Lebanon, the porch of pillars, the throne room, but most importantly, the construction of the temple itself. This is their house of worship, place of worship. And it has been an interesting and, I hope, profitable study for us as we have looked. We sort of went around the temple and peeked inside the temple and talked about the gold inside the temple, the instruments of the temple, the massive pillars on the front of the temple, the lampstands and the tables of showbread and the altar of incense and the massive cherubim in the Holy of Holies. Don't forget, they're 15 feet tall, and two of them sitting here would be just as wide as this building. Massive building undertaken, construction by Solomon. The Holy of Holies, outside those two pillars, Jachin and Boaz, the 10 carts for washing of animals for the sacrifice, the huge bronze sea that rested on the back of the 12 oxen, and then, of course, the altar, the huge bronze altar. 7 years Solomon spent in the construction of the temple. 7 years. It may have been seemed like a long time that we've been studying this, but it hasn't been 7 years. I went back and we actually sort of began this in February of 23. So that has been a while, 15 months or so. February of 23 is when we sort of looked at David's desire to build the temple when God told him no, that he was not allowed to build it. And so even though he was denied the right to construct the temple, David began making preparations for the temple, accumulating men and materials, organizing and structuring things. I'll mention that a little bit more in just a moment. So let me go ahead and apologize to you in advance, because I'm not going to be able to relate to you how big of a deal this is. We've looked at the temple, we've talked about it, we've studied it, but now it is time for the dedication of the temple, the official, quote, grand opening, if you will, of the temple. And this is a massive, major event in the history of Israel. This is significant. If you look at mountain peak moments of Israeli history, this is one of them. This is a crossing the Red Sea moment. This is at Mount Sinai moment, the crossing of the Jordan, the capturing of Jerusalem. This is a mountaintop moment for Israel, the dedication of the temple. And I'm not going to be able to paint it as big and beautiful as I would like and what it deserves, but this is a significant, momentous point in their history when the temple finally done, finally built, is dedicated. So read with me. And I want you, if you're someone who takes notes in your Bible, I do want you to take note of the repetition of the ark. And not to give it all away, but if you don't get this, you don't get my message. That big, beautiful building is just a big box without the presence of God in it. That's the key. And the ark represents symbolically the presence of God, and literally, as God is delighted, that's where he reveals himself, according to Scripture, between the cherubim on the mercy seat above the ark. So you have that ark of the covenant, the lid, which is the mercy seat, the two cherubim, and God's presence dwelling there. And as we read these first 11 verses together, I want you to take notice of how often the ark is mentioned, because that's what this is. It is bringing God, as it were, the ark, where is God's presence. It is bringing God to this temple. And what a glorious celebration, what a glorious time of rejoicing this was. 1 Kings 8, verses 1 through 11. Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the chief of the fathers of the children of Israel, unto King Solomon in Jerusalem, that they may bring up the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh, of the Lord, out of the city of David, which is Zion. And all the men of Israel assembled themselves unto King Solomon at the feast in the month Ethanim, which is the seventh month. And the elders of, all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark. And they brought up the ark of the Lord and the tabernacle of the congregation and all the holy vessels that were in the tabernacle, even those did the priest and the Levites bring up. And King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel that were assembled unto him were with him before the ark, sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be told nor numbered for multitude. And the priest brought in the ark of the covenant of the Lord unto his place, into the oracle, that is the holy of holies from which God would speak, into the oracle of the house, to the most holy place, even under the wings of the cherubims, a big, massive golden cherubim that stretch out over the Holy of Holies. They set the ark underneath that. Verse 7, for the cherubim spread forth their two wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubims covered the ark and the staves thereof above. And they drew out the staves. God's not moving. He's staying there. So they take the staves with which they carry the ark. And they drew out the staves, that the ends of the staves were seen out in the holy place before the oracle, and they were not seen without, and there they are unto this day. There was nothing in the ark, save the two tables of stone which Moses put there at Horeb when the Lord made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. And it came to pass, when the priests were come out of the holy place, that the cloud filled the house of the Lord, so much so, that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of Yahweh. The glory of the Lord had filled the house of the Lord. The dedication of the temple. This massive building project is completed. The work is done. God is pleased, and he lets his pleasure known by coming and dwelling within the temple. And this is a huge one. It is a relief, but it is a great time of celebration. I don't know how I could possibly relate how big of a deal this is. The closest thing that comes to my mind is two things. One, when I was pastoring up in Tennessee, we built a new fellowship hall. They had built a new church building, but they did that prior to my arrival. And we built a new fellowship hall. And when I say we built, I mean we built. We did 90% of it ourselves. I remember many days going and delivering mail, leaving from the post office, and going over and working on that fellowship hall until right about dark. Many Wednesdays, meeting at 5, working on the fellowship hall till about 6:45, and then meeting at church at 7. Still sweating, profusely sweating. But then we got done. We finished it. And there was that first time when the church all sat down together to eat in the fellowship hall. Now, that was a time of rejoicing. It was a big deal. We'd done a lot of work, spent money, been a lot of effort. Now we got to enjoy it. The closest thing other than that I could relate to is the building of our own home. Having it finally completed and being able to spend the first night in our new home. Those are big moments. But can I say, all of that kind of dwarfs in comparison to this. Solomon has efforted for 7 years the construction of this temple. In fact, I sort of got to thinking about this, and my mind ran back, so I went back through some of my notes, and it just sort of leapt off the page that this has been a building, growing, escalating, big deal. Go all the way back, and I'm just going to run quickly, all the way back to King David purchasing this property. And then after he is denied the right to build, he gathers materials, gold and silver, literally billions of dollars worth of materials. He establishes a workforce. He organizes overseers and administrators in preparation for the temple and the worship of the temple. David set 38,000 Levites in particular roles. Now, this is all from my notes. This is all stuff that we've discussed before. David has set 38,000 people as musicians and gatekeepers, those who served in the coming temple in some form of worship or sacrifice. Solomon is crowned king, and he takes that organization of his father to a greater level and employs nearly 200,000 people to build this temple. He enters into covenant with Hiram of Tyre, the king of Tyre, to get materials from him and craftsmen from him. And they spend year upon year upon year building this temple. And now it is done. It's finished. It's completed. But will God be pleased? Will God be pleased? And there is the crux of the whole matter. Yes, thankfully we see from our text that God is pleased, and this is a time to rejoice. A time to rejoice. This big golden box, the temple, is just an empty box without God's presence. So Solomon has the Levites bring the Ark of the Covenant into the temple. And that's really the thrust of this. I want to work quickly through this text and think some about this glorious dedication of the temple. It is interesting that it is the proverbial final piece that is the most important. You get that? It is the Ark of the Covenant. This is the final piece that is brought in. Everything else set in place, priests serving, altar up, wood burning, everything's going. But there's this final piece that leads to this culmination, this apex moment of God coming in and dwelling among his people. Because that's really what it is. When I talk about the Ark being there, it is God dwelling among his people. There is the delight of it. You will see that there is a vast assembly in verse number one of the who is who, the leaders of the tribes, the different leaders of administrative positions that David and Solomon had installed, the heads of the tribes, the chiefs of the fathers, the elders of Israel. Everyone is there. In fact, what you may not read at a cursory reading is this, is that Solomon does this. He plans this meticulously. Notice verse 1, these people that are gathered, they bring up the Ark of the Covenant out of the Lord, out of the city of David. So David had, trying not to drag you through too much history. Remember, David tried to bring the ark and it didn't work out for him. He put the ark on a new cart, and poor old Uzzah, when the cart, you know, the ox stumbled, Uzzah put out his hand to stop the ark from falling and God strikes him dead. Then a little bit later, David says, oh, wait, there's a better way to do this. Let's have the Levites carry it. So they do. But they take the ark into the city of David, and there is a makeshift tent there, where sacrifice and where David goes to pray and this type of thing. But it is separate from the tabernacle proper. The tabernacle is still in Shiloh. The temple here, I'm sorry, the Ark of the Covenant is in the city of David. So those two major pieces are not together. So Solomon is getting the Ark from the city of David, which you have the temple complex, and then just below it is the city of David. And so he sends the Levites to rightly lift the ark and carry it, put it on their shoulders and carry it like they're supposed to. And in verse 2, you'll see that all the people are gathered together in the feast of the month, which is called Ethanim. And that is the seventh month. There's a lot more in that than what you would ever pick up at a cursory reading, okay? There's a feast going on, an annual feast. So that tells us that all the male Jews were required to gather at Jerusalem for this time. So this is big beyond big. We learned that it is in the close of verse 2, in the seventh month. So you could go back, or you can just take my words. Construction is finished in the eighth month. But they don't have this dedication service until the seventh month, 11 months later. And I think this is wisdom, and I think it is just absolutely Solomon's plan to do it this way. He could have done it immediately, but he puts it off and schedules this at a time when the annual feasts are taking place. And in particular, this is September, October, what we call September, October. This dedication service takes place at the Feast of Tabernacles. Let me tell you why that's significant. Because if you remember what is called the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles, is the Israelites, and in particular the men, but it was very customary for them to bring their families because this was such a time of rejoicing. They would go to Jerusalem and they had to build a tent, a booth, and live in it for 1 week. And all of that was intended to remind them of the 40 years that they had spent in their journey from Egypt to the Promised Land. Now, they've been established in Canaan. They've got their own kings. The nation is prospering. But in something... much like baptism or the Lord's Supper, in an effort to remind the people, they had this annual feast where the children of Israel would gather in the capital city, live in these tents for 1 week, and it is a time of just huge celebration. And it's fitting that Solomon schedules this dedication, of the temple, at a time in which God is leaving his tent and coming to dwell in a permanent home. Children of Israel were living in tents. They came to live in their permanent homes. And now, as it were, the presence of God is no longer going to be transitory in the tabernacle, but now it is in the tent. I'm sorry, but in the temple, permanent. His permanent place there in the temple. But not just that. Solomon schedules this around the Great Day of Atonement. That once a year, when the high priest would enter into the Holy of Holies to sprinkle blood there on that great Day of Atonement. And if what I read is correct, and this we can't prove biblically, but one commentator in particular argues that this particular year, when this happens, was a year of Jubilee. And if you remember, every 49th year, the 50th year, was a year of release, a year of celebration. All debts were canceled, all slaves were set free. It was a brand new, starting over. And there's such symbology to all that, right? Isn't that what happens when we come to Christ? All the debts are forgiven, we start over, it's brand new. And so you have the Feast of Tabernacles, you have the Great Day of Atonement, and potentially, if not probably, also this takes place at the year of Jubilee. So this is a huge time of celebration, of rejoicing. Jerusalem is abuzz. And now they've completed the temple and there's going to be this huge dedication service. And I know that's a lot out of just verse 2, but that's what you need to get. That's what's going on in the background. This is huge. This is a major deal for them, that they are having this vast celebration. And so, verse 3, the elders came, the priests bring up the ark. Verse number 4, they bring up the ark and all the instruments and the tabernacle itself. I think a lot of those things are kept and stored in those chambers that were around the temple. You remember we discussed those, those little rooms that were all the way around the temple. They bring up the instruments from the tabernacle, the holy vessels, and they bring them up. Whether or not, say, the lampstand, the 10 lampstands that are in the temple, one of them came from or was designed from the tabernacle, we just don't know some of those things, but they bring them up. And you were talking about a time of sacrifice and rejoicing, verse 5. King Solomon, all the congregation were assembled that were with him before the ark, sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be told nor numbered for multitude. They're going to end up, if I'm remembering right from earlier study, that this celebration is going to end up taking 2 full weeks. They have to build another altar, because they can't even keep up with all the sacrifices that are being brought. This is a huge time of thanksgiving and rejoicing for the Israelites. And in verse 6, the priest bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord into the most holy place under the wings of the cherubim. So now you've got the Ark, and there on the mercy seat, there are the two cherubim facing each other with their heads bowed down. And the Old Testament language is that the very presence of God dwelt there. And in fact, they weren't allowed. You understand, this is a big deal that they're moving the Ark of the Covenant. This thing was shrouded in mystery. It's not a magical box. It was not that, but it was shrouded in mystery. It was covered any time that it was moved. You weren't allowed to obviously open it or touch it. Only the priests could carry it, and that by the poles on their shoulders. But now they're allowed to take it into that holy place and remove that covering from it. And there are those two golden cherubim. And I don't know. This is something I have wrestled with for years. Is there still blood sprinkled on that mercy seat from last year's Great Day of Atonement? And the year before that, and the year before that, and the year before that? I don't know. But then hovering overhead are these golden, massive 15-foot cherubim. These angelic representations of angelic beings that are hovering over that. And then the staves, they remove the staves and set them in such a place that you can see them from the holy place, but not from outside. That verse 7, verse 8, where it talks about the staves being seen, that nobody knows what to make of that verse other than the people that lived it. They understood it. But verse 8, they pulled out the staves. They could be seen from the holy place, inside the Holy of Holies, but not when you were outside or standing outside of the doors of the temple. And in verse 9, there was nothing in the ark except the two tables of stone. The law. You remember? Moses came down from the mount, children of Israel acting like a bunch of fools, very foolishly, sinning. Moses cast down the two tables of stone and they're crushed. Moses goes back up the mount, takes with him two pieces of stone, and God carves again the Ten Commandments. And those then are taken and they're put in. At that time, they didn't even have the Ark of the Covenant. They would build the Ark of the Covenant, and that is placed in there. This would be testing your memory and your history. But there were two other things that were kept in the ark for a measure of time. And one of those was Aaron's rod that budded. And the other was a bowl with manna in it. But at this time, they're not there. Where they are, your guess is as good as mine or anyone else. It's possible that when the ark was taken captive by the Philistines, you remember children of Israel were trying to treat the ark like a lucky talisman and led it out into battle ahead of them, and the Philistines end up taking it from them. Of course, they didn't keep it long because that didn't work out well for them. Is it possible that they removed that the pot with manna in it and Aaron's rod? But I don't know. I don't know where they went. I don't know if they were kept in one of the storehouses, if Israel still had them. All we know is that this time, the only thing that is in the Ark of the Covenant is the law. And again, there's beautiful symbology there that God goes with his word. God, the very presence of God, his word goes with him. His law remains with him. That is one thing that cannot be left behind. The law of God, the word of God, written by the very finger of God. So into that place, that holy place, there is the divine commands, the moral law of God that reveals to all of us that we're sinners and we don't have access into that place except by that mercy seat that is right there. So there's all kinds of richness and symbology there that we don't always get and appreciate. But then as they bring it in, they set it in this place. In verse 10 and 11, it tells us that the priests who were serving in the holy place, whether they were ministering to the lampstands, taking care of them, refilling the oil, or whether they were moving bread from the tables of showbread, whatever they were doing, the glory of God, and this is where we get this Shekinah glory, and we'll talk about that more in the future, but the glory of God, the very presence of God, comes in and fills the temple. And it is so beautifully brilliant and dark. This thick cloud that just shrouds out light that the Levites are forced, the priests are forced outside of the temple. Look at verse 10 and 11. And it came to pass when the priests were come out of the holy place that the cloud filled the house of the Lord so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of Yahweh filled the house of Yahweh. So imagine, here's the king, Levites, leaders, tens, probably hundreds of thousands of Israelites gathered in the courtyard outside of the temple proper. And the glory of the Lord comes down and he fills, saturates, baptizes, as it were, the internal holy and holy of holies within the temple. So much so that it drives out the Levites. And if you're interested, this is the exact same language that was used when Moses finished the tabernacle and the glory of God descended down on it. I don't think that we could fully realize what a big deal this is. God is now dwelling among his people. This big, beautiful, vastly costly building is absolutely nothing but an empty box without the presence of God. And in a sense, the truth is that's the way all of us are. Without the presence of God, we're just an empty shell. We really are. The problem is we try to fill that shell with everything else instead of with the presence of God, and it never satisfies. But nonetheless, I want to build that. I want you to think about this momentous moment, huge moment. Normally, we get way more detail in the Kings than we do in the Chronicles. But this is one place where the Chronicles tells us more than what Kings does. And I'm not going to read it all, but I do want to read a little bit out of 2 Chronicles in chapter number 5. So try and envision this, if you will. Think about this. 200,000 people have been working on this thing for 7 years. Plans for it began 10 or more years ago with David. Materials, men have been gathered. There have been assignments given. Think about this. Tens of thousands of people have helped build. Hundreds and hundreds of man hours have been spent in construction. Thousands of tons of rock has been quarried and shaped. Billions of dollars have been donated and billions of dollars have been spent. 7 years in the construction. And there is this growing, building excitement. 2 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 11. I'm going to pick up where we left off in Kings. And it came to pass, when the priests were come out of the holy place, for all the priests that were present were sanctified, and did not then wait by course. Also, listen to this, the Levites were the singers, all of them of Asaph, of Heman, of Jeduthun, with their sons and their brethren, being arrayed in white linen, having cymbals and psalteries and harps, stood at the east end of the altar, and with them 120 priests, sounding with trumpets. And it came to pass, as the trumpeters and singers were as one to make one sound to be heard, in praising and thanking the Lord, and when they lifted up their voice with the trumpets and cymbals and instruments of music, and praised the Lord, saying, for he is good, for his mercy endures forever, that then the house was filled with a cloud, even the house of the Lord, so that the priest could not stand to minister by reason of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord had filled the house. Just try to imagine that. Gathering of the people. Feast of Tabernacles. The great day of atonement, perhaps even the year of Jubilee. This has been anticipated and planned for 11 months by King Solomon. There are hundreds of thousands of people. It is thought, in fact, I look back over my notes, that at this time Israel numbered somewhere around 4.5 million people. 4.5 million people. How many of them are gathered? And if you could remember at all, that massive temple complex, wall-to-wall people, the Levites are singing, the cymbals and the psalteries are playing, the harps are being strummed, 120 priests are blowing trumpets. They're shouting, singing, and to steal the words of the song, jubilant ringing. People lifting their voices, this glorious orchestra, this priestly choir, shouting and singing, His mercy endures forever. His mercy endures forever. And then in this great culminating moment, the glory of God descends on the temple, and His presence comes and dwells among Israel. God comes in power and fills the temple. All of the work, all of the effort, all the way back to when David first said, I want to build a house for the Lord, has all led to this wonderful moment. The 15 months that we have spent studying the temple and the instruments of the temple was all pointing us towards this one moment when God would come and dwell among His people. The excitement, the anticipation, all of the people gathered, this is a huge deal. But again, at the risk of redundancy, all of that is nothing if God is not pleased. If God's presence does not enter the building, all of that is just wasted. It's a pretty house. It's an expensive house, but it's an empty house. A house needs a tenant. And God comes, and that's why I think the language very clearly says in verse 11 that the glory of Yahweh fills the house of Yahweh. This is His house, His dwelling place. All the designing, planning, engraving, metalworking, building from the huge altar, the bronze sea, the vast twin pillars on the front of the temple, all the way down to the golden door hinges, to the censers and tongs and all of those instruments. All of that effort is meaningless if God is not pleased. But God is pleased. And God is honored by their efforts. He is pleased with this dedication service. And He comes to dwell among His people in the temple. And if the story ended there, it would end on a high note. It really would. If the story ended right there with this loud music playing and the people rejoicing and the glory of God coming, if it ended there, man, that'd be a great place for it to end. Unfortunately, however, the people of God did not value the presence of God like they should. And it wouldn't be very long. It may seem, as we study it, it may seem like a long time, but it won't be very long until the presence of God departs from that temple. Because of their sin, because of idolatry, because of their refusal to worship the one true God, the same glorious presence that entered on this day of dedication departs. And it is devastating to Israel. But there's hope. Because many years later, God would come to dwell among His people again. But this time, He didn't do it in a temple made with men's hands, but in a body, in the person of the Lord Jesus Christ. Glorious, beautiful deity dwelling among men. God dwelled among us. And when He was here, Jesus began construction on His own temple, a spiritual temple, His church. And one day, friends, when it is finished, when it is completed, there will be an even greater dedication service in glory. And that's what I want you to really, all of this is good, all of this is rich, all of this is beautiful, but all of this should just point you forward. That Christ is building His own temple. And when He finishes that, there's going to be a dedication service. And it's going to culminate in that glorious resurrection when we stand before him one day, all of God's people gathered together as one, and God dwells among his people. I couldn't help but as I was reading and studying for this, looking at Revelation 20 and Revelation 21, where we'll see that in that future day there will be no earthly temple because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple. And in a sense, all of this should simply push our hearts forward, yearning for the time when Christ will come. God will come again and dwell among us as he did in the tabernacle, as he did in the temple, as he did in the person of Christ, but as he will do again in the future when he makes all things new. That you think that this, you're talking about a year of jubilee? You want to talk about a time of release and rejoicing? You know, I don't know how many people were here for the dedication of that, but I can tell you there'll be a number there that no man can number out of every kindred and tongue and tribe and nation. That will be a time of true joy when God dwells among us. The highlight of heaven, and I'm going to close with this thought. The highlight of heaven is not the golden streets or the pearly gates. It is that we get to dwell with God forever. That's the highlight of heaven. Unfettered access to God. Here, the priest had to, they had to bail out of the temple because they couldn't stand to be in the presence of God. But there in these new glorified bodies, we will dwell with him. Revelation says that God will dwell with us and he will be our God and we will be his people. There's the real dedication service. This is a big deal. It is a high point in the history of Israel, but all it should do is point us forward to a better day that's going to dawn and a better dedication service when God will again come and dwell among us. Thank you for your attention. I hope that this has been something of a help to you. You may be like me and you're like, man, I'm sort of glad to be done with that temple. Well, that has been rich, but it has been a lot of tedious learning and reading and studying. But this, friends, is a big deal for them, and it ought to be a big deal for us, especially after I've drug you through 15 months of study on this temple. All right.